just to frame what we're doing, so I'm going off a series of books called Tsurba Meirabanan, and I'll explain what that is in a little more depth in a second. But there are actual booklets. I do not have PDFs of the booklets, so unfortunately, unless I figure out a way to get a document camera or something, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to screen share. I still have a few copies of the books left that are available for free. I have like 3 or 4 left. So if you're interested, please let me know. Otherwise, they're available on Amazon, or can try to figure out a way to make sure everyone gets. So what is this Tsurba Meirabanan program? So it was started by an individual named Rav Ben-Tzion Al-Ghazi, who's the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hester Yeshiva in Ramat Gan. Ramat Gan is a suburb of Tel Aviv. And he created a program, he created an institute called Tsurba Meirabanan. He did this with the endorsement of Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Zatzal. And he established this in 2003. So this was actually originally an Israeli program with the sources mostly in Hebrew, but it was meant to cycle through a number of halakhic topics in a 3 or 4 year cycle, doing each topic a week. And for those of you who have the book, you can see that there's actually something like 50 plus sources. So the truth is, I'm not going to try to cover each entire shiur a week. My goal is not really so much the cycle of this. We can talk about that if people are interested in really keeping that cycle, we can do it. But I think it's going to be a little bit much to stick to a half hour or 35 minutes and cover all these sources in the way that the topics are deserve the depth. So the goal is really just to use this as a springboard to learn halakha. And the Tsurba Meirabanan was translated to English by an organization called Manhigut Torahnit, which is actually a post-Micha program in Eretz Yisrael to prepare people to be Torah leaders, to prepare rabbis to be Torah leaders in the diaspora. And then these books have been distributed by Mizrahi, important religious Zionist organization in Eretz Yisrael. So this is the sort of the framework for how all this came to be. So they took these sources from this Tsurba Meirabanan program, which is originally in Hebrew, been translated into English. And if you have the book, you can see it's nicely color-coded. Everything is really looks really nice.
Can I ask you what the translation of that word is?
Tsurba Meirabanan. Sure. Tsurba Meirabanan means essentially a Talmud Chacham. It's an Aramaic word for a Talmud Chacham. Sometimes it means a young rabbi. But
I never heard that term.
So it comes up in the Gemara in a few places. Certain rabbis are referred to as a Tsurba Meirabanan. So the goal here is to get a little bit more depth with Torah learning. With that said, just to give a little bit of a framing for the halakha learning before we jump to kashrus. So there are a couple of different ways to learn halakha. You can learn halakha in a fashion where you learn exactly what it is you need to do, learn the practical things. So a rabbi can get up and say, this is what you need to do. This is what you're allowed to do. This is what you're not allowed to do. So that's one way to learn halakha, is just to know the very basics of what are required and not required to do. Also a way to learn halakha where you learn it in a tremendous depth. And the story specific with kashrus that was told by Rabbi Menachem Ginak, who was the CEO of OU Kosher. So he says that when he learned kashrus with Rav Soloveitchik, so you weren't talking about pots and pans, but you were talking about like conceptual edifice that was like in a totally different world. So there's a way to learn halakha where you're not, you're not coming out necessarily with the practical points, but you're trying to understand the development of the topic in halakha and the conceptual underpinnings and the like. But I think it's very valuable to strike a balance between the two, to be able on the one hand to really know exactly what it is we're supposed to do, what common practice is. But at the same time, I think our practice of halakha can be so much richer, and it's much easier to appreciate what we're doing if we have some sort of conceptual understanding if we see how it developed over time and and some of the reasoning behind how it developed, to look in a book and just kind of, you know, to look at the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and pick up the Psak is a little bit difficult, because if you just kind of look at it at face value, so you don't necessarily know what's motivating that Psak, and does it apply in my situation? So a deeper understanding helps us really get the entire framework. And I like to think of this in the context of there's this parable of the blind men and the elephant. I'll show it to you for those of you who Zoom see on the screen. I'll turn it around for people in person. We have Joseph and Simcha with us. So you have these are a few blind people who are looking, who are touching an elephant, or even if they're not blind, they're maybe only looking at a certain elephant. And so you see, you know, there's a guy on top who thinks it's a fan, and somebody thinks it's a wall, and the tail is a rope, and the leg is maybe a tree, and the what they call the thing coming out. What's that called?
Trunk.
The trunk. The trunk is a sphere. Yeah, I'll turn around for
you guys. Husks. Elephant husks.
Yeah, the husks. Okay. So I am husks. So I think sometimes learning halacha, if you just kind of look in the book, it's kind of like that, where you might kind of see what a particular psak is, but you don't really get the full picture without learning it in greater depth. So when people learn halacha, let's say for smicha, or they just want the greater depth, so the way to do it is that you begin with sukkim in the Torah. And here, actually, the way they advertise this program, it's like you're starting with the Talmudic source going to modern-day halakhic application. But the truth is, there's a pasuk in the Torah. You want to start with that. You want to see what the Gemara had to say. You want to see what the Rishonim, the early commentators, had to say, and particularly the Torah and the Beit Yosef. So the Torah is a four-section work compiled by Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Asher, kind of the predecessor of the Shulchan Aruch. So that's where you get into some of the practical halakha, where he's already deciding between different opinions from the Rishonim. Beit Yosef elaborates on the Rishonim, and then you get to the Shulchan Aruch and the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch later, Tshuvot. So, you know, this is, you're working your way through history, trying to understand how different rabbis in different generations, either in conversation with each other or one after another, how they understood the halakha. A disclaimer that I think is important to make is that it's nearly impossible to paskin halacha, even from these shirim. I think it's not necessarily easy to paskin halacha, because we're only seeing sort of a fraction of what's there, and we're going to go into great depth, but even then it's only a fraction of what's there. But let's say to learn kashrus really, really well takes a year, even a couple of years, to really master. But hopefully this gives us a richer understanding of the development of the laws of kashrus, maybe helps us to refine questions a little bit. So I think it's still worthwhile. One thing we'll also get from this, you know, if you look in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yehuda Hinken and his grandfather, Rav Yosef Eliyahu Hinken Zatzal, so they had issues with using books like Kitzur Shulchan Aruch or maybe an English book, because those books often don't distinguish between what's halacha, what's minhag. That's also something that's important to understand, is like, what's the Doraita, what's the Darabanan, what's the minhag, and that also, all those factors help us understand the halacha a little bit. With that said, let's talk about kashrut a little bit specifically. And just to introduce kashrut is a very important area of Torah Shabbat Alpen, because if you look, those of you who have source books, if you look at the first pasuk that appears here, this is source one on page 25 in the source books. It says, "Lo tfashel gidi b'chalev imo." You should not boil a kid in its mother's milk. So when I teach Torah Shabbat Peh to middle schoolers, it's a concept of Torah Shabbat Peh, I tell them, look at this pasuk and tell me, what question do you have about this pasuk? Sometimes they're like, why a goat or whatnot? But eventually they kind of figure it out. Well, is it only a goat in its mother's milk? What about not a good goat and not its mother's milk? And you see here that when we talk about mixing meat and dairy, you have very little in the Torah to go off of. Almost everything we have in the laws of kashrut is Torah Shabbat Peh. It's the oral Torah tradition that's passed down, development of rabbis, So this is a very rich era of halakha, just to appreciate the importance of Torah Sheba'al Peh, which comes with a particular risk that we might say, well, almost everything's derabanan anyway, so so what does it matter? So you know, we shouldn't this also, you know, underscores the importance of how customs have really kept Jewish tradition alive, and we're not just about what's written in the book, but our family traditions and our communal traditions, and traditions that have existed throughout time, are particularly important.
You know, Rabbi, it's also the fact that we're quoting here from the Torah, it's one little pasuk there, and then you have whole prakim about the Nesiim, about the Mishkan, about Noach and the Teva. There's more on that than there is on Kashrus, which is a fundamental rule. And
that only emphasizes the weight that we give to Torah Sheba'al Peh. Right? We could say that, well, it's only one pasuk in the Torah, right? but this is so foundational to everything we do. And yet a lot of it, very little in the Torah, a lot of it based on Torah Sheba'al Peh. We say the same thing about Hilchos Shabbos. Mark Chagiga is very explicit about that also, that the laws of Shabbos are like a mountain hanging from a thread. So a lot of what we do is of that nature.
I was going to say that along with Shabbat and Taras and Mishpacha, Kashrut is one of the three pillars of Jewish family life.
100%. 100%. So that's, again, its importance, but also in the context of Torah Sheba'al Peh. Why can't we mix dairy meat together? So the pasuk tells us not to cook a kid in its mother's milk. So what's the importance of not cooking kin in its mother's milk? So the Rambam says that this has to do with, and this is not in the source books, I'm going through this very quickly. The goal of this year is not Tami and Mitzvah, but just to get a broad appreciation. The Rambam talks about how it was an Avodah Zarah thing to do meat and dairy together. The Rashbam and the Ramban talk about how, especially on the Shalosh Regalim, the Pasuk here goes back to, in a couple of places, to the Shalosh Regalim. So on the Shalosh, on holidays specifically, non-Jews would boil kid in some of this milk. So we don't want to be like them.
We literally.
I don't know if it was kid in some of this milk or they would mix dairy meat together, but they say that there was some sort of non-Jewish act that was like this, even if it's not a Avodah Zarah, but not something to emulate. And Rashbam goes further to say that this halacha teaches us not to be overly indulgent and to be
cruelty issue, maybe.
Yeah, so some bring up the cruelty issue. Sefer HaChinuch says that certain mixtures, just like shatnez and kilayim, so we don't want to certain things that are not natural to mix, we're not supposed to do. And you know, that gets to the cruelty thing. Maybe it's not natural to mix life and death like that together. Ibn Ezra says that it was an Arab custom, minhag ish ma'alim. But at the same time, Rabbeinu Bakia says that not having dairy meat together is a chok. It's a law that we don't understand. So you have different mefarshim who have different approaches to why we don't mix meat and dairy together. So again, it could be that there's a historical root, or that there's a moral idea behind it, or it's just simply something that Kadosh Baruch Hu told us not to do.
I thought we had a chokim and mishpatim weren't argued upon. They knew this is a chok, this is a mishpat. They actually argued whether it is a chok or a mishpat.
I mean, like if you look at, for example, Sefer HaChinuch, you know, takes all sorts of things that are mishpatim and tries to give reasons for them. So I wouldn't say it's too clear of a distinction. Okay, but let's get into things. So the Torah told us not to boil a kid, to cook a kid in its mother's milk. The Gemara Masechet Chulin says, quotes Devei Rabbi Shmuel, the school of Rabbi Shmuel. So Lo Tzvashel Gadi B'Chalei Bimo Shalosh Pamim. It appears three times in the Torah, twice in Shmot and one in Dvarim. So famously, Echad Isra Achilu. One tells you that you're not allowed to eat milk and meat together. One teaches us that you're not allowed to benefit from it. So, you know, you can't sell a mixture of dairy and meat together. And one is to prohibit cooking. So even though it says cooking three times, One really is about eating, one's about benefiting, and one is specifically cooking. The Targum Onkelos actually says that he translates all three places that Lo Tevashel Gediba Chalei Mo is don't eat milk and meat together. So that's how he translates it. But again, the Gemara understands that the three different prohibitions of eating, cooking, and benefiting from dairy and meat together. So the Torah, source 3 on page 26 in the book. So he says in the bold part, V'hotzi Yisra Achila Bilshon Bishul. It's only prohibited from the Torah to have dairy and meat together when it is cooked. So if I cook a cheeseburger, so that is the prohibition from the Torah of both cooking and eating the cheeseburger. So a deli sandwich with cheese. So let's say you have cold turkey and cheese, and you don't cook them together. So that's not technically prohibited from the Torah because you never cook them. But I'm not allowed to eat it from the Torah. So if I cook dairy meat together, I'm not allowed. So that cooking itself is prohibited. Then eating it would be a prohibition from the Torah. And if I sell it, it's also a prohibition from the Torah. If I'm just happen to be eating it together, but I didn't cook it, so that is technically an Isser D'Rabbanan. The Torah goes on to say, not specifically, not just exclusively a goat, but this applies, of course, to an ox, sheep, a goat, a cow. So as we can imagine, the prohibition of cooking dairy and meat together is not just about goats, but it's anything.
What if it's not cooking?
What?
What if it's not cooking? What if I have a little thing and I'm serving non-Jewish people? And I take some turkey and cheese and make them a turkey and cheese sandwich.
So that would be a rabbinic prohibition technically, because you're benefiting from it, but you didn't cook it, so that's technically a rabbinic prohibition.
What if you cook it, but it's
correct? We'll get into a nuance of that in a minute, but that's what happened, Gloria.
But it's not milk.
What would the Karaites do? Will the Karaites then eat like a turkey sandwich with cheese?
That's a good question. I don't know. Okay. I don't know. That's interesting. I want to look into that.
What about cooking in a different liquid?
What do you mean?
Not milk. The pasuk says milk.
So
cooking could be accomplished with other liquids, with water.
Well, but there's still cheese and there's still dairy and meat that's been cooked together, even if it's in water, you're saying?
No. Instead of, right. The item is together with the meat, but it's cooked in a, it said in the milk, which means there's a liquid.
Right. So
it's not a liquid.
dairy and meat being cooked together is the Torah prohibition. End of story. Okay. Now the Aruch HaShulchan says that this is a little bit unusual because usually most things that are prohibited from the Torah, I'm allowed to get benefit from. So let's say you have a fruit that's orla. So if I sell it, I'm allowed to get benefit from it. But when it comes to dairy and meat, I'm not allowed to benefit from that. And likewise, when it comes to other areas of kashrus, so there are certain things I'm not allowed to eat, but cooking would not be a problem. So let's say, cooking pork on its own is not necessarily a prohibition, but when it comes to dairy and meat, so not just eating, but cooking them together is problematic. So this is an unusual prohibition. There's an interesting nuance that the Mishnah brings. This is source 5 in the source book on page 26, that the technical prohibition of cooking dairy and meat together is when the meat comes from a kosher animal and the milk comes from a kosher animal. So beef and milk from a cow, that's a Torah prohibition if you cook it together. Okay, I'm not allowed to cook and I'll benefit But basar behema tahora bechalav behema tmeya basar behema tmeya bechalav behema tahora. Let's say I do pork and cheese from a cow. So technically, cooking that together is technically permitted. Technically permitted from the Torah. So there's a place, you know, somewhere where I was growing up, that a place called Potbellies. So I think it was like a pork place. So while, let's say, making a cheeseburger with cow meat is totally off limits from the Torah. So but the pork and, you know, ham and cheese, technically speaking, to cook it or to benefit, I'm not allowed to eat it, obviously. But to cook it technically is not a prohibition from the Torah. And is only an Isser Durabanan. And Rabbi Akiva learns that let's say Chaya and Oak, so chicken, for example, is also not included in the Torah prohibition of having dairy and meat together, right? So you might have heard before that chicken was parved at some point. So going back to the period of the Mishnah and Gemara, you would not have chicken and dairy together, but Rabbi Akiva learns that the reason why the pasuk of Lo Tivashel Galiba Chalevimo appears three times in the Torah. You know, we saw before that had to do with eating, benefit, and cooking. But he says it's to exclude an undomesticated animal, birds, and non-kosher animal. So chicken and dairy is also technically an Isser Derabbanan. With that said, the Rambam explains that the chayin basar chayav, this is verse 6, the chayin basar chayav of bein b'chalav b'chalev chayav bein b'chalav behema eno asar b'achila min haTorah. So again, cooking dairy and chicken together, or cooking pork and cheese together, technically not a prohibition from the Torah. But asr bechil medivrei sofrim. But we don't do this from the rabbis. Kedeshu pashu ha'am v'yavolu de iser basar bechal shel Torah. So we do this in order to we don't have chicken and dairy together in order to prevent ourselves from violating a Torah prohibition, right? So again, you know, chicken and dairy technically not prohibited from the Torah, but it's a strong rabbinic prohibition not to do it because it could lead to something that's problematic. Okay.
Would duck fall in that category?
Right, duck is a bird, right? So same thing with duck.
Oh, any bird.
Any bird. Okay. So right, so there are Ramah Paskins in source 7 that any bas brachal that you're not allowed to do from the Torah, you're allowed to get benefit from. You could pork and, let's say, chicken and cheese, you technically could sell.
Technically, but not beef.
Not beef and cheese.
What about unkosher beef?
Unkosher beef and cheese, meaning if it comes from a kosher animal, then you still have a problem. But let's say it's pork and cheese, technically allowed to sell.
So when would we do this if we want to open a diner and sell these kinds of items? Technically, we could.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really recommend it, but
just curious.
So they bring in the footnote here. You know, can one work at McDonald's or hold chairs in it? So again, I mean, you know, if you're really following everything to the T, so you can kind of get away with things, but most non-kosher restaurants are going to have, you know, beef and poultry and pork and the like. So, you know.
The problem is when the customer is Jewish and you're serving him this food.
Right, so that's also a potential pitfall. Again, I don't recommend it, but we're laying things out, what's technically permitted and prohibited from the Torah. So the Yalkut Yosef.
Rabbi, did you also say it's about something about shareholders?
So the shareholders thing, I'm not entirely sure about, and I would want to look into a little bit more to figure out, like, if you're allowed to have shares. But in theory, you could be let's say if you're benefiting from a non-kosher chain that sells, you know, cheeseburgers, so maybe you're getting benefit from that. That could potentially be problematic. So I don't know, practically speaking, how people navigate that, but it's definitely a question. I'll look into that and get back and come back to that next week. Yaakov Yosef brings up a question about whether you can pour, say, boiling water in a trash can, because maybe you have both dairy and meat in the trash can. Is that a problem? So Rav Yosef says that, technically speaking, there's really no prohibition there, because you don't really know that there's both dairy and meat and that they're touching each other and that that's going to cause them to cook. But at the same time, so maybe if you know, let's say there's pizza at the top of the trash can, so you shouldn't pour, you know, fat from the meat that you were just cooking that's still boiling. So maybe that you shouldn't pour directly on it, because that could technically be cooking dairy and meat. But and to not pour something boiling water into the trash can is a little bit of an extraneous stringency. So he also says that you can launder towels together. Let's say you have, you know, tablecloth from a dairy meal, tablecloth from a meat meal, that you can launder together. There's no concern of Basar B'Chalav. So that he brings up. Okay. So creating here. Let's go a little bit further, and then we'll call it a day. Okay, so wading between dairy and meat. So now we know we're of course not supposed to eat. We're not supposed to eat dairy and meat. Not supposed to eat dairy and meat together. And the Torah prohibition again was in theory is to cook it. And if it was cooked, we're not allowed to eat it also from the Torah. So how do we get from there to wading between dairy and meat? Because, you know, in terms of, let's say, if I eat meat and a half hour later I eat dairy, I'm not really necessarily eating them together, right? So this source is the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Kuf Hei Amud Aleph, 105a, on page 29. This is source 9. Amar Rav Chista, Achal Basar Asar L'chol Gvina. Somebody has meat, they're not allowed to eat cheese. Amar Ukva, Ana Laha Milta Chala Bar Chamer L'gabe Ava. Bar Ukva says, I am vinegar, the son of wine, with regard to my father, because my father would wait a whole 24 hours between between meat and dairy. He ate meat, but wait a whole 24 hours to eat dairy. I wouldn't eat it at the same meal, but the next meal I would eat. So it sounds from this Gemara that Mar Ukva's father went above and beyond what was required. 24 hours is definitely not required, but there's something about waiting to the next meal. So that's a very important foundation for the custom that we have to wait between dairy and meat. So the question we have to ask is, what does the next meal mean? So according to the Rush, there's something to do with time. So beginning of source 10, he's quoting the Gemara, but so he explains on the top of page 30, Perish bizmana sharagel adam lisod, dehaim bizman sudat haboker, bizman sudat haeret. So how do we define one meal from the next meal? From the morning meal to the evening meal. So they didn't have necessarily three meals a day. They had two meals a day. So less than that. So between the morning meal and the evening meal, or that equivalent time, is a time that you have to wait. You can't have dairy after meat if less than that equivalent time has passed. But once that equivalent time has passed, it would be allowed. But he doesn't define exactly how long that is. But again, something from the morning meal to the evening meal. So the Rambam comes and says that it's about 6 hours. He's actually not so precise about it being 6 hours. Again, in that time, they might not have had the precision of exactly 6 hours. We talked about on Shabbos on Gadol that, you know, precision at time, especially in previous generations, the Torah is not given to angels. And sometimes we say that, let's say, a mikvah has to be exactly 40 sa'ah, not anything less. Sometimes we say that, you know, if it's 6 hours, so 5 hours and 59 minutes and 6 hours is not a big difference. This is dairy after meat, right? So the Rambam says that it has to be about 6 hours, approximately 6 hours. Sounds like 5 hours and 59 minutes, probably not so problematic. but that's what he says. Melech HaMishnah explains that he gets this from the fact that that the mules of Talmidei Chachamim were at 6 hours. There was a 6 hour interval between meals for Talmidei Chachamim. Their first meal would be 6 hours after sunrise. And the next meal would be 6 hours. So Mar Ukba with Talmid Chacham, that's the standard there. But we get this notion of 6 hours from the Rosh and the Rambam that say that from one meal to another is a certain amount of time, which we seem to indicate as 6 hours. Tosfot and Kula in source 13 on top of page 31 says that when the Gemara says that you have to wait another meal, when Mar Ukba says you have to wait another meal, doesn't mean literally between lunch and dinner. Once you, in the times of Chazal, they actually like ate on like tray tables. But once you remove the table, which indicates you're clearing the table, the meal's over. Once you remove the table, you clear the table and you benched, you're allowed to eat dairy. So it could be that, if I have shawarma for lunch, once I clean up and I benched, I'm allowed to eat dairy, according to Tosafot. Jarring, right? You would never think that this is something that Rishonim would allow. Maybe from the Torah, you would never think Rishonim would allow, that little time, but that's what Tosafot says. It's another Tosafot that quotes Rabbeinu Tam, source 14, that says that you're not allowed to eat cheese after meat without nitilan kinuach, without washing and wiping, washing one's hands and wiping one's mouth. Well, the nitil v'kinuach shari. So sometimes we say between dairy and meat, you need to rinse. Tosfot here, Rabbeinu Tam, is saying that you can rinse also between meat and dairy, and that would be enough. The two approaches in Tosfot there: one is you have to clear the table and bench; another that you have to wash your hands and wipe your mouth. But that would be considered another meal. And Mar Ukva, who would wait till the next meal, was being a machmir. So his father was a super machmir, and he himself was also being a little bit stringent. But really, according to Rabbeinu Tam, it's enough just to rinse your mouth and wash your hands. So how does this play out halakhically? So Shulchan Aruch says that if somebody eats meat, even poultry or an domesticated animal, 6 hours. And even if you wait 6 hours, if there's meat between the teeth, we'll come back to this next week, so you would have to remove it. Okay, so Rav Yosef Karo for Sfardim says 6 hours. With that said, the Ramah says that if one finds meat between their teeth, you have to rinse their mouth. Some say you don't have to wait 6 hours. Rather, it's enough to remove the table and the bench, like Tosfot said, and to rinse and wash your mouth. So he combines the two Tosfot opinions that you have to clear the table, bench, wash your hands, and rinse your mouth. We'll get there in a second. So Rama says that, in theory, some say it's enough to remove, to clear a table, bench, and wash your hands and rinse your mouth. 1 hour. We often associate that with the Dutch custom. Rama says that in Poland, they did 1 hour after meat, and then you could have cheese, or you could have dairy. But you would have to bench, but without benching, waiting an hour is not enough. But he goes on to say,
but wait, what if one didn't have bread?
So then at the very end here, he says, Yesh bedaktikin lahamtin shesha od achar afila basar l'gvina v'chein nachon lanso. There's some who are stringent to wait 6 hours between eating meat and dairy, and this is the proper thing to do. So Rama says that really the custom where he lived apparently was to wait 1 hour. He says that people should be strict and wait 6 hours. And the Shach and the Taz, the Shach says, Shach is the commentary, is one of the major commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch for Kashrus. So he says that somebody who has a reach Torah, somebody who has like a sense for Torah, should wait 6 hours, like the Rama says. The Taz, the Turei Zav, also says a ben Torah person should not be more lenient than 6 hours. So again, 6 hours. So it seems widely agreed that you have to wait. You know, the most lenient opinions allow you to rent your mouth. Seems like most people say you have to wait. But you know, the Rama says that the custom in his time was 1 hour. But both he and Rabbi Yosef Karo agree that ideally, like the Rambam, one should wait 6 hours. We'll see other customs. Zoom's actually going to run out in a minute. So we're going to end here. But thank everyone for joining. If you have any feedback in weeks forward, please let me know. Again, if anybody would like a copy of the book, I still have a few left. And wishing everyone a wonderful week.
Thank you. This is fun. Thank you. Right. This book is actually very excellent.
It's a great book. It's a great book.
I mean, it's really.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. All right, have a good night, everyone.
Good night. Bye.